Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, April 15th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York, and working from his home studio, producing from his home studio, is Taylor Schwenk. There's sad news to report about Hank Steinbrenner, part of the Yankees ownership and son of George Steinbrenner. He passed away at age 63, surrounded by family, surrounded by friends. Former Kansas City Royals and Chicago Cubs manager Jim Frey died on Sunday at age 88. This according to the Atlantic League Somerset Patriots, the minor league team he had been affiliated with since its launch in 1998. The Patriots did not announce the cause of death. Employees of Major League Baseball teams are participating in a massive study that will test up to 10,000 people for coronavirus antibodies. This according to Jeff Passan. And as he writes, this should offer researchers a better sense of how widespread the disease is in major metropolitan areas across the United States. Doctors caution that the data gathered is not expected to hasten the game's return. Former Red Sox player and 2018 World Series MVP Steve Pierce said he has retired after a 13-year major league career. Like Mark Reynolds, who we talked about in the podcast yesterday, Steve Pierce, someone who was very well liked and respected by teammates. Well, Jackie Robinson Day in baseball. This is the day everybody in baseball wears number 42 to honor Jackie Robinson, who broke baseball's color barrier in 1947. Before we continue Hall of Fame week with longtime pitcher and broadcaster Jim Palmer, with stories about Al Kaline, about Mickey Mantle, about Mike Messina, and we talk with Paul Imbachides, here's a look at Jackie Robinson's legacy, narrated by Vin Scully in 2013 from MLB.com. The second voice you'll hear is that of Rachel Robinson, his wife, and then longtime teammate Don Newcomb.
The true measurement of a legend is its legacy. Now, 66 years after Jackie Robinson broke baseball's color barrier as a Dodger, the legend endures. Today, we celebrate the legend and those who have helped carry on the legacy. People like Rachel Robinson, Jackie's loving wife, who supported him and has continued to carry his torch.
I want young people to know that you can go through really terrible times, but if you form relationships and use those relationships to keep you strong, that you can make a difference.
People like teammates Don Newcomb and Roy Campanella, who were pillars of support during his playing days and endured the same bitter discrimination as Jackie.
Vern Trickey said, if this fails, Jackie, this is going to be set back another 30 or 40 years. It might never happen. You cannot afford to fail. Now, can you carry that burden? And Jackie said, yes, Mr. Rick, I can carry it. I will never forget Jackie. I still think of him as my idol, for what he did for me and what he did for all black people in this world, not just this country, in this world.
Today, we celebrate the legend, as does Major League Baseball on every April 15th. As does the new feature film, 42, which prompted our First Lady, Michelle Obama, to recognize the sacrifices and strength of the Robinsons.
This isn't just about watching a wonderful movie and about an important moment in history. This is about helping all of you believe that you can write your own history and demand more of yourself every single day. You have to do that. You have to pick up yourself when somebody knocks you down.
Today, we continue a legacy so that tomorrow they will.
I'm extremely proud and pleased to be here this afternoon, but must admit I'm going to be tremendously more pleased and more proud when I look at that third base coaching line one day and see a black face managing in baseball.
Jackie Robinson, more than a baseball legend, an American legend.
Today, I think every American should say a special word of thanks to Jackie Robinson.
And the fans will never forget the sight of Jackie Robinson.
Before we hear from Hall of Famer Jim Palmer and Hembo, check out today's episode of ESPN Daily. 2020 was supposed to be the Dodgers' year, and a chance for Clayton Kershaw to get his postseason glory. What will this moment mean for the great pitcher's legacy? That on ESPN Daily. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you can listen to this episode in the Baseball Tonight feed. Jim Palmer was inducted into Baseball's Hall of Fame in 1990, and he's been a longtime broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles. Jim, thanks for joining us and helping to distract us during this time when we don't have baseball to watch.
Well, we all need distractions, you know. I mean, if you're not washing your hands, if you're not socially distancing, you know, I think, you know, I always supposedly had that love-hate relationship with Earl Weaver, you know, the late Earl Weaver, who, you know, got in the Hall of Fame, I think, in 1996. This would have been a perfect situation because I always wanted to socially distance myself from Earl, at least stay 6 feet away from him. And I say that jokingly because, you know, we both ended up in the Hall of Fame and, you know, everybody said we had this love-hate relationship. But I think the love part of it was we liked to win, Buster. But and the other thing is, just think about it. You know, Earl took the job in, what, 1968 at the All-Star game and until 1980, one-year deals. And for him to give me the ball every 4 days all those years is pretty pretty trusting, so to speak. And, you know, so, again, we may have had our dust-ups and our moments. Not that I was the only player that happened with, but he always trusted me enough to be able to allow me to go out there every 4 days and hope that I would be able to help the Orioles win a pennant.
It's funny you mentioned the joke about socially distancing yourself because Mike Messina's Moose, as you know, bought that house in the middle of the mountains up in Pennsylvania. And I asked him if he could, you know, come on if he had some time. And he goes, "Hey, I invented social distancing," talking about his personal.
Well, I actually haven't seen Mike since he got in the Hall of Fame because I wasn't able to go. And I knew that, you know, the first game I ever did with Mike was a 1-0 loss in Chicago when Frank Thomas, who one of the few guys that, of course, Frank Thomas is in the Hall of Fame too, with over 500 home runs, but he beat him 1-0 to the home run to center field. But I had, you know, I tried to make that comeback, I think in 1991, I believe. And I was in spring training with Mike Messina, but once you saw him pitch, I knew I was seeing a guy that was as good as any of the. And I pitched on some great staffs with Cuellar and McNally and Flanagan and McGregor. He was as good or better than of any pitcher that I ever, you know, pitched with. And, you know, when you talk about a guy like Mike Cuellar, who we got, you know, from the Astros in 1969 or the winter 68-69, won 139 games in 7 years. People don't realize how good he was. But Mike could do so many things to win. And, of course, he pitched in the steroid era. He pitched, you know, won 7 gold gloves. I'm not sure I would have liked to have pitched in Camden Yards being a fly ball pitcher with guys walking up the home plate that looked like cartoon characters.
Yeah, you're exactly right. He, you know, so many unique skills. And one of my favorite memories about Mike was he got in the 2001 World Series, his first year with the Yankees, he got absolutely pounded in the first game by the Diamondbacks, especially their left-handed hitters. And when I was covering the Orioles and then that year covering the Yankees, I always charted every game Mike pitched. And so I knew his repertoire, you know, 91, 92 mile an hour fastball, had the curveball, had the changeup. And then when he starts his next game, it makes his next start in game 5 of that World Series. He comes out, he's throwing this pitch that's clocked at like 84, 85. And the Diamondbacks are struggling. This is before, you know, super slow motion on television. And I was trying to figure out what it was, and I ran into the broadcast booth, and I found Rick Sutcliffe. I'm like, "Sut, what is that?" He goes, "I think it's his curveball." I'm like, no, it's too fast.
Yeah.
So I thought about it.
Yeah.
No, I thought about it on the flight. You know, the Yankees win that game in extra innings. I thought about it on the flight to Arizona, and I walked up to Moose before game 6, and I said, "Did you really break out a splitter in the middle of the World Series?" And he held the finger up to his mouth and went, "Shh," which to me – like that to me was Mike Messina and how smart he was.
Well, you know, just because you go to Stanford doesn't mean you're smart, but he did go to Stanford and he was smart. So, you know, I mean, I asked, you know, when we had Jimmy Key and Scotty Erickson, and, you know, I looked at him one day and when I was broadcasting and he's pitching and I said, is it easier now that you have, you got Jimmy Key and you got Scotty Erickson, you know, on the same step? He says, "Jim, it's never easy." And I said, "Okay, Mike, let me rephrase that. Is it less difficult?" So, you know, again, you kind of had to be on your toes. But, I mean, a marvelous pitcher. I was so happy that he did get in the Hall of Fame. You know, I mean, you know, if you look at the era he pitched in, it was a very difficult one to pitch in. The strike zone was about the size of an 8x10 piece of paper. You know, you did have the PEDs, the steroid era. You did pitch in Camden Yards. I know you pitched on good ball clubs for most of those years, which, you know, I certainly know about how that makes it less difficult, if I want to phrase it that way. But at the end of the day, he could really pitch. And, I think it, you know, nowadays, and we all know this, you know, he only won 20 games, and that was the last year. And he looked at the iron to me because I saw him that year, and he said, you know what? He said, I just hope I win 20 because, you know, you did it 8 times or whatever. And he said, I would like to do it. And then he ended up doing it in his last season, and then he retired. So, again, marvelous pitcher. You know, if you look at that era, you got Glavitt and you got Maddox and you got Randy Johnson, the obvious guys because they had over 300 wins. But I think if you really wanted to look at guys, and you've kind of touched on this, I don't know if I ever saw, and I pitched with a lot of great pitchers, Buster. I'm not sure I ever pitched with somebody or watched somebody pitch that could make adjustments in game as well as Mike Mussina. And what you talked about, the fact that, you know, I mean, he came up with a little bit of a split finger fastball, something a little bit different. You know, I saw him, he did have a great changeup and he had the two knuckle curveballs and, you know, two seamer, four seamer pitch to both sides of the plate. But he came up with a little cutter when he would get into fastball counts. And can't tell you the countless amount of ground balls I would see being hit to shortstop because it just had a little bit different movement.
We talked to Jim Codd recently, your peer, and he tells a great story about starting Game 7 of the 1965 World Series against Sandy Koufax. And he said at that time that the starting pitchers always stood side by side before the game and had their pictures taken together. And he remembers watching Sandy go out to warm up when he went out to warm up for that game. And, of course, a year later, you start Game 2 of the World Series against the Dodgers. It was the last appearance of Sandy Koufax ever made. And I'm curious about your memories of that interaction with Sandy leading up to that game.
Well, you know, I watched my first year in the big leagues was 1965. So, you know, I was kind of occasionally a spot starter, but mostly out of the bullpen. You know, I rode with Robin Roberts early in the year. He was 38. I was 19. And, you know, I put him to sleep asking him questions. About 1 o'clock in the morning after Johnny Carson was off, I'd say, Robin, and he goes, kid, I'm twice your age. He said, we'll talk about this at breakfast. So, I mean, I had a great mentor. And of course, I watched that World Series. I mean, I also, I used to go to the Coliseum when I was in Southern California, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade. So I used to go to originally, you know, the Coliseum when the Dodgers played. I saw Koufax again, you know, this is like 1955, 56, when he hadn't quite got his act together. You know, the guy that they wouldn't let warm up where anybody can see you, he'd be down in the bullpen because he had command problems, which I certainly can relate to. I walked 130 and 129 innings in A-ball and then went to instructional leg and worked on my windup, which is kind of what Sandy did. But I knew how good Koufax was. And, you know, 66, I mean, if you go back and look at game one, we stayed at the Continental Hotel, which Gene Autry, who owned the Angels, owned. And he was there the night we got in on a Sunday night. He was actually there. I mean, you know, the singing cowboy. I mean, I'd grown up with Roy Rogers and Gene Autry, if you're in that, you know, era. And I mean, I was kind of an on. We were going to the ballpark on the first Tuesday, and Laugh In was one of the popular TVs, and they had a real estate thing, and it said, instead of a 3-bedroom, 2-bath house with pool, it said, Dodger, would you believe Dodgers 4 straight? Well, we win, you know, the first game. Brooks and Frank Robinson hit home runs in the first inning. I think really what if you go back and then you look at the next three games, game 2, 3, and 4, I beat Koufax 6-0. Really, Willie Davis beat Sandy that day because he dropped 2 fly balls and threw the second one that he dropped on it. I mean, it really wasn't a bright, sunny day like you can get in San Francisco or Oakland. There wasn't any wind. He just dropped him and picked up the second one and threw it in the dugouts. We got some unearned runs, so I got 6 runs, and I pitched my first shutout ever. But I really believe that the thing that I didn't want to do was embarrass myself. I think Sandy won 27 games that year. I think if you go back and look, you know, his ERA was under 2 runs a game. You know, normally a Sandy Koufax game would be a 1-0, 2-1, 3-2 affair. Maybe, you know, I think he pitched 12 shutouts. And really the only thing I didn't want to do is embarrass myself. But I think the key to that World Series was Mo Drabowski. Mo came in relief of Dave McNally. and struck out 11 Dodgers in 6 2/3 innings. And, you know, after Brooks and Frank hit the home runs in the first inning, I said, boy, you know, we might have a chance to win this game. You know, we had a good ball club. We had won 97 games, only three more than we had won in 65 when the Twins, as you mentioned, went to the World Series. But they won 102. Frank comes over, hits 49 home runs, two more in the World Series as the MVP, Triple Crown. But Mo Drabowski came in, and, you know, Mo we had picked up for $25,000 on a waiver wire. And he had a great arm, great command, great breaking ball. And I was sitting there at age 20 and going, you know, they're having a little trouble with a high fastball. And on that particular day, as I mentioned, I pitched my first shutout. You know, my command was pretty good. The fact that Willie Davis made the two errors, or really three errors on two fly balls and then an errant throw, you know, I got enough runs where, you know, again, it wasn't a 1-0 game, which is what happened when Wally Bunker beat Osteen in game three, or when McNally came back and beat Don Drysdale 1-0 in Baltimore on the Frank Robinson home run. So, you know, again, I think a lot of times you know, if you're a young pitcher like I am, then you just go out there and compete. And the stars were aligned that day, you know, again, because of the errors and the fact that, and who knew that was going to be Sandy's last game, because he was coming off of just a typical Koufax a year. You know, if you go back in, you know, from 65 to really, you know, maybe the early 60s to 1966 when he won 27 games.
What do you remember about getting word that Sandy was retiring? Was it a surprise for you? And did you ever get a chance to talk to Sandy about pitching against each other that game?
No, but, you know, you mentioned the fact that you always, you know, kind of take pictures with the starting pitcher. And, you know, on the Monday, you know, before, I think the first game was Tuesday, and I think maybe the Wednesday game was, you know, the game that, and I'm not, I believe that's the day that I ended up pitching. I know it was game two. I remember taking, you know, shake hands with Sandy. But, you know, again, when you grow up in Southern California for 4 years and you go to Dodger Stadium and, you know, people say, well, who did you want to emulate? I wasn't left-handed, so I really couldn't be Sandy Koufax. I could be Don Drysdale, who, you know, made every right-handed hitter that got into the box uncomfortable because he was very much like Bob Gibson. You know, you dug in, you were going to go on your, you know, your rear end. You know, Koufax, you know, Sandy was more genteel. Probably, I mean, I probably was more of a right-handed version where, you know, I only think I hit 39 batters in maybe 4,000 innings. It's not that I couldn't pitch in. I was more of a kind of a vertical, not a horizontal pitcher like Drysdale or Gibson or whatever. And Sandy was just the same type of guy. But, you know, anybody that, you know, I mean, I knew about the perfect games and the no hitters. I mean, he was Buster. He was Sandy Koufax. You just, like I said, you don't want to embarrass yourself. And, you know, again, I don't think anybody anticipated, number one, the Orioles winning in 1966, because as you mentioned, Dodgers had, you know, they'd beaten the Yankees in 63. They beat the Twins, who were a really good ball club, in 65. And then all of a sudden, you know, they're playing the Orioles. And again, why we had a good team, you know, we won 97 games. I think that everybody thought that their speed and especially their pitching would dominate it. And it's just amazing that one team in four games only hits 125. And that was the batting average for the Dodgers against the Orioles pitching staff in 66.
Yeah, still by the numbers, the worst performance for any team in World Series history. You mentioned
No. Let's rephrase that, Buster. It was the best pitching performance of any team.
There you go.
I'm only kidding. Yeah.
So you mentioned you hit how few batters you hit during your career. Your manager Earl was not in line with the thinking of a lot of other managers who believe strongly in retaliation. He was kind of ahead of his time. And I remember a story. We mentioned Mike Mussina. You know, early in his career, there was a huge dust up between the Orioles and the Seattle Mariners. And Mike hit Bill Hasselman because he was told to. And then he got hurt in the subsequent brawl. And Mike told me after that, he said, I never would do that again. How did you feel about Earl's handling of those situations and the way that he viewed the whole question of retaliation?
Well, I played for Earl from 69 through 82. And the only time I ever remember him telling anybody to tell anybody was a game that in 1976, Reggie Jackson came over. He missed five weeks, you know, hit 29 home runs. That kind of cost us the pennant because, you know, he held out. He wanted a 5-year deal, and the Orioles really didn't have much foresight. because he would have signed for a lot less than he ultimately would sign at the end of the year as a free agent with the Yankees. But we were playing and Doc Ellis was pitching and, you know, somebody tried to drop a bunt down and, you know, Doc, you know, looked into the dugout and yells, you know, the next one of you so-and-sos, I'm going to hit you right in the side of the head. And Reggie got up on the third step. He says, you want to hit somebody, hit me. Well, next time up, Doc hit him right in the side of the face, right below the jaw, maybe a little bit underneath the ear. And they brought the EMG truck right out on the field and they took Reggie to the hospital. And I go out to pitch the top of the ninth inning and I have a 4-0 lead. And Earl looks at me as I'm going up the steps and he says, you know, we can't let that happen. Now, that's the only time I ever heard him ever do it. And as it turned out, you know, the first hitter was Elrod Hendricks. He'd been traded to the Yankees, along with the Rick Dempsey, Tippy Martinez trade and whatever. And, well, I'm not going to throw at the guy that caught my no-hitter. So I throw him, actually, I hung a curveball, and Elrod flew out to deep right center field for the first out. And here comes Mickey Rivers. And trying to hit Mickey Rivers, because if anybody had ever saw Mickey play, he was a marvelous player. But he was always moving. I mean, he was like, you know, the guy, you know, the arcade bear you're trying to hit with a rifle when you were a kid. Yeah. You know, to win a prize. Well, it took me 4 pitches to nick him in kind of in the, not in the rib cage, but really got his uniform. And of course he goes down to first base, Earl, because it's 4-0, plays, Boog Powell behind him. And then, or this would be Eddie Murray hadn't been there. I'm not even sure who was playing first that night, but anyway, we play behind him. He steals second base because they give him the stolen base. Roy White dumps a single in it. Now it's 4-1. So I lose my shutout. I end up getting 2 outs. We win 4-1. We go to Detroit early in the morning the next day. And Lee McPhail, I walk into my hotel room and Lee McPhail, the phone rings and it's Lee. Hey, how's the family? How's the weather? By the way, he said, I read in the paper where you said that you were protecting your teammate. I said, yeah. I said, you know, ask the umpires what Doc yelled from the mound. Everybody could hear it. You could have heard it in the mezzanine. Anyway, he said, that's going to cost you $500. And so for, you know, hitting the one guy that Earl Weaver told me to hit, which was Mickey River, and I didn't hit him in the face. I mean, I nicked him in the uniform. Cost me $500. I got the Joe Cronin Award because I did a lot of work with cystic fibrosis. I got invited to get the award at the playoffs. And I'm sitting next to Lee, and he goes, by the way, he says, you know, I've never gotten that $500. So I said, oh, yeah, I'll send you the check. Well, I forgot about it all winter, and I get a telegram from the American League office the day before I'm going to pitch opening day in Baltimore. He said, if you expect the pitch, you know, tomorrow, I need to get the money. So that's the Earl Weaver philosophy. Grant Jackson came over. He buzzed somebody up in Seattle. Earl ran out to the mound. He said, take a look at our third baseman. Is our third baseman better than theirs? And Buck said, yeah. And he goes, well, how about our shortstop? We went right around the field because Earl didn't want anybody hurt. You know, he just realized that again, we had really good clubs. If you played on you played and you didn't get hurt and you didn't let your ego and, you know, get in the way of good sense, we were in a lot of games. And that's why Earl got in the Hall of Fame and we went to 6 World Series.
I looked it up, by the way, as you were talking. Lee May was your first baseman for that particular game. I wanted to ask you about pitching to various Hall of Famers and what that was like. I looked up your numbers against Mickey Mantle. He was 1-for-14 with 7 strikeouts against you, the one hit being a home run. What do you remember about pitching to him, and what was that like as a young pitcher the first time?
Well, you know, we put on all the shifts now, and I mean, I'm not sure I'd be a big advocate of a lot of the shifts, but I think the first time I faced Mickey, he hit a ground ball through my legs, and I go, you know, I kind of hung my head, and Louis Aparicio, who, you know, ends up in the Hall of Fame, is playing shortstop for us in 65, you know, catches and throws him out. The one hit you talk about happened in 1966, I believe. And, you know, Mickey was at the end of his career, in the sense that his knees were pretty much shot. Much better hitter when he was facing left-handed pitching, hitting right-handed. And, of course, I was right-handed, so I got this, you know, and I just ride the fastball on him. And so I strike him out the first time, afternoon game at the stadium. And he comes up the next time, I think maybe the bottom of the sixth or the bottom of the seventh inning. And Andy Etchebarren, who was catching, said, Mick, you're choking up. He says, yeah, I'm going to try to hit that high fastball. And I go 2 balls and no strikes on him. And I look over, and guess who's on deck? Roger Maris. Now, even at age 20, Buster, I was smart enough to know you are not going to pitch around Mickey Mantle with a 2-0 lead and on 2-0 count you're going to try to give them something to hit. Well, I took a little bit off to try to throw a strike. And there used to be a football spotter's box on the third deck, just to the right of where the bullpens were. The bullpens back then were up the chute in right field and up the chute for the, you know, the visiting team in left field. Well, he splintered the box. I mean, it didn't go as high. It wasn't a night game like it, you know, Robert Redford did in the natural, but it was close enough. And that's the only hit that Mickey ever got off me. But, you know, I mean, I saw him hit his 500th home run off of Stu Miller at the stadium. And, you know, somebody tweeted, you know, well, what are you doing now? You know, you're social distancing yourself. You're washing your hands, trying to get some exercise, you know, probably watching more TV than you really need to do. But somebody, I tweeted the other day, they said, you know, how about Mickey Mantle or who did you grow up? And I said, I just have a Mickey Mantle glow. I mean, I grew up in New York. I was adopted at birth. I love the Yankees. My dad, just like Billy Crystal talks about in City Slickers, he took me to the stadium in 1954. It was a Tuesday night. It was before color television. And when I walked up with that, you know, up the stadium ramps, it was raining that night. And I think Allie Reynolds pitched for the Yankees and Mike Garcia pitched for the Indians. I didn't like the Indians in 54 because they beat the Yankees and then would lose four in a row to the Giants in the World Series. But that was my first time. And then 10 years later, I came in relief of Frankie Bertena after Phil Lynch hit him in the hand and loaded the bases up. There were a couple of guys on an infield hit and then struck out Tresh, Mantle, and Marison about 12 high fastballs. So you never kind of forget the kind of things when you're dreaming about being a major league player. So I always kind of was a Yankee fan, but Mickey was my guy early on. Not that I didn't like Yogi or, you know, John Blanchard, who seemed to always hit a home run on Saturday when the Yankees were on CBS with Pee Wee Reese and Dizzy Dean. So, you know, again, when you grow up as a Yankee fan, boy, what an honor it is to pitch against the Yankees.
Harmon Killebrew against you, 133 average and 20 strikeouts. And look, he was my perception of him, I only talked to him one time, was that he was one of the more genial guys in baseball. Again, I'm curious because you're both Hall of Famers. Did you ever get a chance to talk to him about, did you like talking to hitters at the Hall of Fame about your shared experiences?
Well, I tried to do it before that. They used to have an American Airlines golf tournament where they would have baseball players play with football players. And I always try to hang with the hitters. You know, Ron Santo, I hung around with him one of those golf tournaments. I mean, they would have them, and, you know, it would be either be in Hawaii or maybe Puerto Rico or Phoenix or Palm Springs. And in fact, you know, so I was always trying to pick their brain. And then, of course, Santo beat me 2-1 on a home run in the eighth inning in Chicago. And I go, he was doing the same thing. But, you know, Harmon was the first guy that hit him so far that he would actually, and I don't think he ever tried to show up pitchers, but, you know, in the old ballpark at Metropolitan Field or Park or whatever they called it in Minnesota, there used to be a seat way up in the upper deck. I mean, it was so far. And I think Carmen hit two home runs, one off of Jack Sanford and somebody else on back-to-back games. And, you know, those were, it's kind of like the red seat in Fenway Park where apparently Ted Williams hit a ball, you know, before the ball was juiced as it has been the last couple of years. But Harmon would hit him so far. And, you know, I lost 3-2 one Sunday afternoon in Baltimore. I struck him out the first three times up. I threw him a low and away fastball. Davey Johnson made an error, a couple of guys on, and he hit it over the right center field fence. So Harmon was very much like Frank Robinson and a lot of the, you know, Frank Howard, a lot of the great hitters that I faced in that era, where it wasn't just the mistakes. You know, I mean, you could, and this was a pretty good fastball, except that, you know, this was Harmon Killebrew. But I was sitting with him on my table. You know, when you go to the Hall of Fame and you go to the induction, you come back to the Otisaga Hotel, and then they have a dinner. Used to be with the league presidents, which they don't have anymore. Now it's with the commissioner, and they give the Hall of Famers that are inducted the rings. And I'm sitting, let's see, I got Ryan Sandberg to my left. I got Gaylord to his left. And then we go around the table. We got Harmon, and then I have Ferguson Jenkins. And I, you know, we're talking about TEDs and all that. And Harmon looks across the table and he says, Jimmy, I just don't think I could have cheated. And I looked at him and I go, Harmon, you didn't need to cheat. But he was that type of guy. And, you know, I mean, just like, you know, I think one of the, you know, we're going through, COVID-19, it's affected so many people around the world and deaths and people losing their jobs and out of work and all that. You know, and then you know, one of the true gentlemen of the game, Al Kaline, passes away. You know, it's been a tough spell, I think, for all of us. But you know, people have asked me about Al, and of course, you know, my first start in the big leagues was 1965 when I was 19, and I pitched against Denny McLain, and I hadn't pitched in spring training as far as starting, and I got in. You know, Willie Horton went over the hedge, you know, to tie the game up in the seventh inning. You know, I probably threw about 140 pitches, even though I hadn't probably thrown more than 60 all spring training. But Al Kaline comes up, and I knew who Al Kaline was. And I struck him out the first time, and Dick Brown was catching for us, and throw him a fastball, curveball the next time, two strikes, and Dick puts down a changeup. And I throw him a changeup, he hits it off the foul pole for a solo home run. And I'm 19, and, you know, so I said, okay, we won't do that again. And then the third time up, I throw him, I don't know, 96, 7, 8 mile per hour fastball low and away, and he hits a single into right field. And Buster, this is when, even at age 19, I'm saying, you know what? There are going to be hitters that I face that are better than I am. And, you know, I learned. I mean, I think the first guy I faced, you know, that really taught me that lesson was Al Kaline. And, you know, a couple of, you know, 2012, we had all the statues. You had one a month of all the Hall of Famers, retired numbers. And the Tigers were in town. And Al actually, came to to my ceremony in July. You know, came to the ceremony, sat on the field. My stepson, Spencer, who has autism, ran out on the field and introduced me. You know, a lot of people didn't think he would do it, but he loved to. I never could have done it when I was 15 years old. But, you know, let's hear it for number 22, still the greatest, the most amazing. That's exactly what he told me to say, Jim Palmer, and then Spencer runs off the field. And I see Al afterwards. He said, boy, that was something. And then 2 weeks later at the induction, up at Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, he says, you know, every time I think about that, I tear up, because it was such a great thing to see a child with autism. You know, and of course, you know, he's been with the Tigers, forever. And Jim Price, who does the radio, has two kids with that are autistic. And so he kind of knows about autism. But, you know, it's just amazing, Buster, and you know this as well as somebody that's covered baseball forever. You know, a lot of times I think we look at players and we say, oh, yeah, this guy, you know, a 4 or 5 tool player like Al, because Al could do everything, won 10 gold gloves, almost hit 400 home runs, 399. But a lot of times it just takes little special things that happen in life that make you realize not only was this guy a great player, but he was a great person.
Oh, and that came through in the tributes that came out from people who knew him. I got a text message that night after we got word about Al passing from Brad Ausmus, who, of course, who was a manager with the Tigers. He said, look, I don't have a social media following, but I really want to put this out there, and talk about what a great person he was. And, you know, people weren't talking about what type of player he was as much about what a great person he was. We talked to Bruce Bochy the other day, who someday, he's going to be making his speech in Cooperstown and be at the Otisaga with you. And I asked him, because he managed Barry Bonds, and I asked him how he felt about the question of PEDs, and you mentioned, the conversation with Harmon Killebrew, and Boach's feeling is that he almost, you could tell, he defers to the people who are there. He said, look, people in the Hall of Fame, this has come up, and they've made their feelings clear, and I would respect their feelings on it. As time has gone on, has that changed your feelings about it?
You know, first of all, 444 baseball writers voted, you know, for me. When I got the call from Jack Lang, it was about an hour and a half late because they thought I was at another restaurant and they were trying to find me. And, he says, oh, I have kind of good news and bad news. And he said, well, the bad news, 33 writers didn't vote for you, but the good news is 411 did. I didn't vote for myself. So, I learned in 1990 that, it's a very exclusive club, obviously. I mean, the year I got in along with Joe Morton was one of the great players, two MVPs and on some of the great teams, Cincinnati Red teams. We got rained out. And so instead of having the induction on Sunday, they had it in the gym on Monday. You know, Joe and I said, we need to go out and acknowledge the people. Because they're like, 10, 12,000 in a pouring rainstorm. And when we went out, everybody stood up and the umbrellas. And I mean, it just, chills through your body. So I think if you ever go to not only a baseball game, but if you go to Cooperstown, you realize the love affair that people that care about baseball have, and they show it on induction weekend. You know, I mean, I don't know if we're going to have it this year, but obviously you're going to see a lot of people that had the luxury to to see Derek Jeter play. So, but what I did find out that induction weekend is that they had the dinner on Sunday night, and Stan Musial, who's, you know, one of the great hitters of all time with his, you know, 815 at home and 815 on the road. And one year he would have led, if he doesn't get a home run rained out, he would have led the National League in singles, doubles, triples, home runs, RBIs, on base, you name it, down the list, and the humblest guy in the world. But he had been sick the year before, and Ted Williams grabbed the microphone and started just talking about how great it was to see Stan back and in better health. And then they passed the microphone around, and right then I realized, and we even made the speech more difficult the next day when I followed Joe Morgan, is that, you know, these guys, you know, it's an exclusive club. You care about yourself. You know, I mean, obviously, you know, Bob Gibson, one of the great pitchers, he didn't talk to these guys when he was pitching against them. But now you can actually be friends. You know, you kind of alluded to it when you're sitting at a table with Norman Gillibrew and you actually get to talk to a guy that put a lot of fear in your heart. So, but I guess, Buster, you know, who's to say there aren't guys in the Hall of Fame already that have done PEDs? You know, I mean, I look at, you know, Bonds, who, you know, I was reading today, the Athletic, and Joe Pazanski had him number two player. I think anybody that ever had a chance to see Barry Bonds play early on, no, he was a Hall of Fame player, five-tool guy, you know. I mean, one, I don't even know how many MVPs he won. Clemens was the same way. But it'll be very interesting when they, I mean, they're getting closer and closer, but I'm not going to begrudge them if the Hall of Fame deems them viable to be in the Hall of Fame, because I don't vote. You know, I have a lot of respect for Barry. You know, I played against his dad, who was a marvelous player. You know, same with Roger. I played for Cal Ripken Sr., so I learned early on in A-ball there are no such things as shortcuts. So it probably would have been a difficult decision to make when you see other people doing it, or other guys are, you know, hitting 65, 70 home runs, maybe, or whatever. Maybe there's an inkling or something to do, you know, as far as doing that. But at the end of the day, you make a great point. We don't, you know, Bruce is perfectly right. He's not going to vote himself in. You know, if it was that easy, you know, he'd already be in there. And we all know, I mean, what, three World Series in, what, about 5 years? So you know he's going to get there. And, you know, I went on a cruise with him. I don't really like him because he beat me in ping pong. But other than that, we all know what a great manager he was. You know, I blamed it on the high seas that day. But you know, again, so I just think, you know, when you get to the Hall of Fame or you talk about the Hall of Fame, boy, it's such a special club that you know, you're just happy to be in there. And, you know, the great thing about it is once you get past your first, you know, the induction weekend, then you actually can go and have a good time.
Oh, that's you what know? Craig Biggio told us that the other day, that after the first
exactly.
year, it's easy and it's fun and it's very comfortable. And last one for you, you know, you mentioned the writers that didn't vote for you. That bothers me. And when I go back and I look at the voters who didn't vote for Hank Aaron and Willie Mays and Jackie Robinson, and this year we had one voter who didn't vote for Derek Jeter, I don't get it. And it bothers me. Do you care at all about that when you follow that? You know, we saw the other, what was it, a few years ago, I think three or four writers didn't vote for Ken Griffey Jr. And I can't stand that.
Well, that's because they want to be different, I guess, you know. I mean, how do you not vote for, you know, DiMaggio? Or, I mean, what, didn't DiMaggio have to, you didn't even get
year.
In the first year or something?
Right.
Well, come on, you know. Yeah, right. You know what I mean? Because he didn't stay married to Marilyn Monroe. I mean, I don't know, you know, I don't look at that. I mean, you know, Joe, like I mentioned Joe Pazanski's name. I'm not even, you know, somebody said, you must be in the top 100 players. And I said, no, I didn't make the list. And, but, you know, people say, oh, you didn't strike out enough guys. And, you know, I asked an analytical writer in Baltimore a couple of years ago. I said, you can get numbers. I said, did my strikeouts go up with a runner at third and less than two outs? He said, oh yeah, it went up 21%. I said, well, there you go. So, you know, I mean, they, you know, and I read an article in SB Nation that I was the luckiest Hall of Fame pitcher because my batting average on balls in play was .239 for my career. And, you know, and I had good defensive players. So therefore I should be penalized. Buster, let me bottom line this for you. I was really fortunate to sign with the Orioles. I played with some of the greatest players and then some of the greatest staffs. The reason I'm in the Hall of Fame is because that's exactly what happened. You know, I mean, you know, I had a Hall of Fame manager in Earl Weaver. Everybody says, you know, I mean, I mean, I've been watching Ken Burns, some of the baseball things, and Don Boswell said I had complexes on top of complexes and whatever, and I wouldn't have won 50 games without Earl Weaver. I won 50 games. I won 268 games because I played with some of the best players ever. And you can just go down the list. And some of them aren't even in the Hall of Fame. You know, the Paul Blairs, the Mark Belangers with eight gold gloves, the Richie Coggins, who with two outs in the ninth inning, Mike Ferraro hits a ball that's going to hit the chalk line, and Richie's sitting on the line or standing on the line almost as it straddled and catches the ball. Sure double. You know, 2-0 lead, two outs in the ninth inning, and you know, I'm waiting for him to come in. And I said, what were you doing there? He says, played against that guy last year. I knew he couldn't pull you. I knew what you would do. Well, that's how you get to the Hall of Fame. I mean, that's, you just have players that come out of a great organization, you know, that want to win, know how to win, know you have to do it together. And it's kind of like we're going to do with COVID-19, you know, where we're not going to beat this by ourselves. I didn't get to the Hall of Fame by myself. My parents told me to sign with the Orioles because I could have signed with any team. I was a year before the draft, and it turned out pretty well.
You're exactly right. Well, Jim, stay safe. As always, I'm amazed by your memory. I'm amazed by your knowledge, and I appreciate the time.
Well, you're welcome. I made most of this stuff up, Buster, but am I going to see? I guess the big question, will I see you in Arizona? Are we actually going to play any baseball at all this year? Hopefully that'll be.
Yeah, I hope so.
But anyway, you take care.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Why, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
And Hembo is Paul Embiid. He's a researcher at ESPN who's also a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. I have not confirmed that yet. Hembo, thanks for listening to the podcast interviews we've been doing, and you got a chance to listen to the Jim Palmer interview, and he made some references to his unusual relationship with his manager, Earl Weaver.
He sure did. I mean, it seems that, you know, for the entirety of their relationship, it was, he described it as, you know, as the as social distancing before it was cool. But what strikes me statistically is that the Orioles were the winningest team in baseball during Earl Weaver's tenure with the team, and Jim Palmer's durability enabled him, Buster, to employ that famous four-man rotation. As you know, Palmer ranks third all time with 132 wins on 3 days rest. He talked about that in the podcast, behind only Walter Johnson and Warren Spahn. And he posted a higher win percentage than either of them in those starts.
We talked about with him about his start against Sandy Koufax in 1966. That's a special badge of honor for a young pitcher like Jim Palmer was back then. But it was a precursor of what was to come.
Jim Palmer is the only pitcher to throw a postseason shutout before the age of 21. And like you said, he did so against Sandy Koufax and the Dodgers in game two of the 66 World Series. Palmer is also the only pitcher to win a World Series game in three different decades. And in three consecutive years, Buster, spanning 1969 to 1971, Palmer threw a complete game to clinch the American League Championship Series, allowing a total of 6 runs in those 27 innings.
I mentioned earlier this week on the podcast, my favorite stat about Jim Palmer was that during the course of his career, he never allowed a grand slam. What do you make of that?
Well, it's wild. He also never allowed back-to-back homers, which I think is equally wild. As far as the grand slams are concerned, opponents posted an OPS of 432 against Palmer with the bases loaded. That is the lowest mark for any pitcher to face at least 100 batters in those circumstances since that data became available in the year 1974.
You're kidding. I didn't know. It was, wow.
He was I'll that kind of good.
I'll have to text him to make sure that he hears that note today once the podcast posts. And it's always fun, I always think, to talk to all-time greats about other all-time greats and get their observations. And he talked about Mike Mussina.
Mussina retired, Buster, as the all-time leader in postseason innings without a World Series ring, a distinction now held by Clayton Kershaw. But Mussina's career ERA in the postseason of 3.42 was lower than Pedro Martinez and Randy Johnson and Jack Morris and Andy Pettit. He was more clutch than many of his contemporaries that we perceived as such. Further, Buster, Mussina was a metronome. There were 11 seasons in which he qualified for the ERA title with an adjusted ERA of 125 or higher, meaning at least 25% better than the league average. The only other live ball pitchers to pull that off are Roger Clemens, Lefty Grove, and Greg Maddux.
just as a fan, what'd you think of Messina revealing that they ran that tape out to left center field at Camden Yards and found the distance where it says 364 to be 346?
I love the story, and I love the way I love how understated he is. Like, that's the kind of story that I would, if I was telling it, I would try to build it up. But Mike Mussina delivered it just as Mike Mussina was. He was just so himself in that interview. It was tremendous.
And last thing for you, today's Jackie Robinson Day. What do you got?
Buster, I maintain the opinion, as you know, that Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier was the most significant event that occurred on American soil during the 20th century. I think it goes without saying the importance that it had in baseball lore from 1887 to the year in which he broke the barrier. Obviously, there were no black players in the big leagues. And also, I think you could argue that culturally his impact was equal to, or at least close to, that of Martin Luther King Jr. So I think he is on a pillar with Martin Luther King Jr. in terms of what he established culturally and historically by breaking the color barrier. A couple other notes I'd like to throw in about Jackie Robinson, though. Some people probably know, some people probably don't. It was actually Monty Irvin who was the choice of the Negro League owners to be the first black player to integrate. But he obviously had wartime obligations, and as it turns out, obviously, fate had it that Jackie Robinson had that distinction. I think we can all agree that that worked out just fine. Further, from 1949 to 1962, Buster, 11 of 14 MVPs in the National League were African-American. That group includes Jackie himself. It includes Roy Campanella, Willie Mays, Don Newcomb, Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Frank Robinson, and Maury Wills. He very much opened the floodgates and broke down the door for these guys who came in a rush right away. And that span of 14 years, 11 black players won the National League MVP. And the last thing that I'll say, Buster, is for as much as he did, for as culturally significant as he is, I think sometimes we forget how great a baseball player Jackie Robinson was. In the 10 seasons spanning 1947 to 56, the span of his career, Stan Musial was the only player to produce more value by wins above replacement than Jackie Robinson. If he had done nothing culturally or historically significant whatsoever, he would be remembered as a much greater ball player than he actually is. He was a true superstar for nearly the duration of his 10-year career.
And oh, by the way, he didn't make his debut until he was 28 years old. So maybe we didn't even see the actual prime Jackie Robinson as opposed to, in 1946, maybe at the end of 1945, because he did serve in World War II. Just a remarkable player, remarkable figure. And can you believe how many people didn't vote for him the year he came up for the Hall of Fame? I mean, you heard what Jim Palmer said about that. I feel the same way. It boggles the mind when I see that the people who didn't get votes for the Hall of Fame.
You know, Buster, like I like to say, if you're building a baseball Mount Rushmore, there are two prerequisites on that Mount Rushmore. Jackie Robinson is one, Babe Ruth is another, and we can argue about the other two.
100% agree. All right, Hembo, thanks for doing this.
Later, boys.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. Cinegrades at Cinegrades writes in that he really enjoyed yesterday's interview with Mike Messina. And he says, Moose finally won 20 games in his very last season. What do you remember about him in his final year that was different from previous years?
Well, Moose made reference to the fact that he had to make adjustments throughout his career. You know, changing, throwing from different arm angles, picking different pitches. He actually, what I remember specifically is he slowed down the velocity of his curveball. You know, typically in his prime, he'd been, if I remember correctly, like 79 to 80 miles per hour in that curveball. I can remember times in his last couple of years where he was throwing like 71, 72. So he built up the differential between his fastball and his off-speed pitches. I felt like so that it was effective for him in that last year.
Tyler Burnett writes in at Tyler Burnett 28. He has an interesting question. Do you know this? Did Mariano Rivera get a new jersey on Jackie Robinson Day, or did he get to wear his normal one?
No, he got to wear his normal one on the day that the first Jackie Robinson Day was held, which was April 15th in 1997. Bud Selig basically grandfathered in everybody who wore number 42 to continue to wear their own number 42. I remember I was covering the Mets that year. Butch Husky was their third baseman, and he got to continue to wear 42, and so did Mo. He got to wear number 42. Now, I'm guessing that, and I don't know this specifically, if there was a sleeve patch of some kind, I'm sure they added it to his uniform, but it was his uniform.
Interesting. Last one up from Portland Maverick at the Battered Bees. He's putting out a conspiracy theory out there. I'm picking up what Taylor is laying down, an abundance of Orioles interviews. Coincidence? I don't think so. Next, we'll be subjected to the likes of Eddie Murray, Brooks Robinson, Frank Robinson, Cal Ripken. Wait, that actually sounds awesome. Great work. I don't think it's not actually a conspiracy theory. I think I've just seeped into your subconscious, Buster, and you're like, you know, on some level, you're like, what would Taylor enjoy listening to?
Right, and it might have a little bit to do with the fact that these are people I know.
Oh, yeah, that's important too.
And sure. I covered the Orioles, so I know Mike Mussita, covered Billy Ripken, Jim Palmer. That probably has something to do with it. But it has been interesting. I thought about that, having Oriole pitchers on back-to-back days.
Not complaining over here.
All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Jim Palmer, to Hembo, to Taylor. Thanks for listening, everybody. Stay safe. And on our way out, here's more on Jackie Robinson. And in this clip, you'll hear from Jackie, from Pee Wee Reese, who I was lucky enough to meet when I was 11 years old, Eddie Stanky, Rachel Robinson from the Rogers Photo Archive. Give a listen.
In that summer of 47, very few people knew that Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson were going to be great teammates. They would become the boys of summer. Jackie Robinson, though not embraced by all of his teammates, did indeed win them over one by one. Pee Wee Reese, another Southerner, was the first to really embrace him.
Pee Wee, from the outset, felt that if I were the only white guy trying to break into all black league, I'd want somebody to be my friend. And he says, if Jackie Robinson has the ability and he can make it, that's all I'm going to ask.
We had some deep South boys on there, you know, down in Alabama and in Georgia, and they didn't appreciate it at all. And if you sat down and played cards with Jackie or something, they would let you know about it. You know, how in the world can you sit down and play with this so-and-so? Hey, man, he seemed like a pretty nice guy to me.
To Philadelphia, Jackie Robinson was the most hated man in the world. There was no one else who could comprehend his loneliness, his isolation. It wasn't until the Dodgers went on the road and his teammates saw how he was turned away at the front desk of the hotels that even a hardcore Southerner like Eddie Stanky could see that this was a social injustice.
Well, we'd go into St. Louis on the bus. Poor Jack had to go to another hotel. That's pretty hard to live with. Sure he had it, but never changed his personality or his thoughts about the game. When that game started, that first pitch, he was all ball player and all man.
Only with this woman, Rachel Robinson, Jackie's wife, could he let his guard down. He was a lonely man on an island with very few friends. Only Rachel could comprehend how difficult that first year was for Jackie.
He felt disappointed at times, frustrated, disillusioned, down. But he would pick himself up. He's very resilient and very determined, you know, really stubborn about the thing. He was going to make it work.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight. The podcast.